From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
So Woolworths and Big W have banned glitter in all their Christmas decorations this year. I don't think many people will lose sleep over the move, especially parents for whom glitter is up there with head lice and gastro when it comes to things they don't want in their house. And that's because glitter is the worst. It gets everywhere and it hangs around forever. The glitter from Christmas tree ornaments will still be turning up around your house months later, or you'll be in a big meeting at work and realise a little piece of the stuff is stuck to your face and your boss will think you've been moonlighting as a drag queen, which I would totally do, BTW, as soon as I can figure out my drag queen name. Bell Tower? Las Anya Topper? Okay, it's a work in progress, but back to glitter. And if you think it's a problem because it hangs around your house, it's even worse when it gets out into the environment. That's because glitter is usually made from a combination of aluminium and plastic, and unlike other plastic items that gradually break down until they become microplastics, glitter starts out that way. Now, I shouldn't have to tell you how bad microplastics are, but we have a little time, so I'm going to anyway. You see, we're only just starting to realise that the microplastic issue is way worse than we first thought. One study in 2020 found microplastics can become airborne and come down in rain. The CSIRO found that 9 to 15 million tonnes of the stuff are embedded in the seafloor. They found it in Arctic ice, in the bellies of whales, and humans are estimated to ingest about 5 grams of microplastic every week. Just as an FYI, that's about as much plastic as you'd find in the average credit card, and we're eating it every week without knowing it. Don't know about you guys, but that's frankly terrifying. Now, glitter might not be the biggest culprit in all this, but it certainly is one of the most unnecessary and easily removed culprits, which is why big retail chains around the world have been stamping out glitter in their store brand products for years. This is not a new thing. So while it's great that Woolies and Big W have shown some initiative when it comes to removing glitter, the real question is, why didn't they do it sooner? Coming up on the show, the assassination in Nangarra overnight. Plus, we'll cross to Florida for an update on Hurricane Ian. And it's Friday, so our good mate Jeff Parry is back. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live.
Making news.
And joining us now from the Channel 7 newsroom is Cyan Valance. G'day, Cy.
Happy Friday, Benjamin.
We have made it to the end of the week.
Somehow.
Somehow. Are you still working tomorrow, though?
No, I have the weekend off.
Oh, you have
off.
The weekend
it's
off.
Unprecedented.
Oh, that's good. Because I thought you might have had that unfortunate situation as a fill-in where you're filling in for someone else's job, but then you also have to do your job and there's that overlap, which just makes it not that much fun.
Well, it is day 6 of 6.
Oh, there you go.
But
there you go.
We've made it.
You've made it. You're nearly there. Just got to get through this segment and then we'll release you into the wild. And now, talking about wild, a more bikie-linked violence in Perth overnight. We're going to cross to Channel 7's Emily Baker, who's on the scene after we finish this segment. So we'll get the latest on that story. But when you hear about something like this, do you worry? Do you worry about your own safety?
I honestly don't, because, I mean, I think the messaging from police is very clear. This was a targeted attack. And if you're not involved with the bikies, it's sort of, you know, arguments within the clubs or between clubs. And so I don't personally worry. You do worry about people being caught up, like the little boy at the motorplex who was hit by, you know, part of a stray bullet. But it was obviously very targeted. It's one of those things. Honestly, my first thought was, oh, my gosh, again.
Yeah.
Again. It didn't used to be this common.
Yeah, and this is the thing, right? Because the WA government has come out and talked extremely tough about cracking down on the bikies, and like you just have to show a tattoo, a bikie insignia on their clothes, and they'll face big penalties. We saw quite a few of those insignias and tattoos on show with the mourners around the scene of the crime in Nangarra overnight. I guess we'll wait and see if the police are going to take any action over that, but. You know, it's hard to see those tough laws really having much of an impact at the moment.
Well, obviously they haven't. Someone's just been shot dead. So, it is interesting to ask what impact the laws have if, you know, the violence just goes on the same. Like, what's the point?
Yeah, and that's just, and this is just the most obvious example of it. Like, what we're not seeing is all of the kind of the under-the-radar criminal activity that's happening as well. And so I guess we'll wait and see a little bit more about this story as it unfolds today. But now let's talk about this smoke haze that's hanging around Perth. So last night, I smelled smoke in my house and I thought, hang on a minute. So is there something going on that I need to worry about here? And then opened the window, sort of went outside into the backyard, and it was smoky. It was extremely smoky. And so do we know what's going on?
Prescribed burns. So we got up yesterday. The weather's stunning. I actually went to the beach after doing our little segment yesterday, and it was one of those actually perfect days that you don't get anywhere else. You know, you go out there, it was clear, it was calm, it was stunning. Guess what? It's also perfect for the Departments of Parks and Wildlife to start some fires and backburn to hopefully mean that this bushfire season that's coming up won't be as bad. So you can understand why they're doing it, but it was so disappointing in the afternoon to go outside and it's hazy and gross, and it was massive. So the smoke warning stretched all the way from Two Rocks to Rockingham, and in between, everyone with breathing difficulties, like those with asthma, are being told, you know, like, stay indoors, turn off your air cons, because, you know, for someone like me or you, it's annoying if you have breathing difficulties. It's actually sort of dangerous.
Yeah. And I guess it's good, I suppose, that it's school holidays, because at least you don't have all the kids at school breathing it in the playgrounds and stuff like that. Parents can, you know, take them to the cinema or just keep them inside for the day, so that's all right. But yeah, the timing, not amazing, because Perth does have just the most beautiful spring weather. Sometimes we're lucky over here.
Some days you nail it and it just takes your breath away. I love it.
And now this story broke yesterday, and it's really, really one that is a nightmare. These meth-smoking parents have managed to avoid jail for neglecting their child, but the details of the story are absolutely horrific.
Yeah, they got suspended jail sentences, and this, you know, sometimes there's not much that surprises you in this job, but this was just disgusting. So these two parents have been in a different room, basically just getting high on meth. And in the next room, their two-year-old toddler was being beaten and abused by her older siblings. Now, all those siblings are 10 or younger, so obviously they need some help. But this child was bitten. She was bruised, she was beaten, she had infected fingers and toes, and an injury that's usually only seen in rugby players, cauliflower ear. So she was beaten so badly and so often that her injuries were something that you'd see on an elite sort of contact sport player.
Yeah, which is from repeated injuries
repeated
to the
injuries.
Ear. That causes like the, you know, like the tissue and blood vessels and everything to just become completely trashed by those repeated injuries, and they end up with this crazy swelling of the ear. Like, I actually could not believe when I read that was one of the injuries that this poor little kid has sustained.
That poor little girl. And they did take her to the doctor and they said, you know, her big brother did it, blah, blah, blah. But then they took her home. The doctors called police. That's when police came, arrested them. They got their suspended jail sentences, but they still have custody. They still have this little girl, which to me, that surprised me more than them not going to jail.
Yeah, all you can hope is that it's just a massive wake-up call for them and they just, you know, lift their game. Like, just, it's,
well,
but it's so hard
so.
Though, right? Like, we know how addictive meth is and just it ruins families all over Western Australia, all over Australia. But gosh, you just really hope that things are okay for that little girl and her older siblings as well, right?
They obviously need help.
Yeah. Because it's a cycle that just continues, goes around and around in circles. And it's like, you wonder how it's going to end up. And I'm thinking the same about the Aussie dollar at the moment. So, If you're a billionaire with a thriving export business, you're probably loving where the Aussie dollar is right now, which
spoiler alert, I'm not.
In the toilet. And so tell us, how is the Aussie dollar doing at the moment?
Not great, Ben. Mm. Not if you're heading off to America, especially. So yesterday it fell to, I think it was 63 US cents. Yeah. It's back to around 65 now. The average for this year is 68.5. Look, it's not great, but what the falling dollar is good for is the state budget, because a lower Aussie dollar boosts the value of royalty income. So even though the price of iron ore is going down, the royalties are going up because of the Aussie dollar falling. It's a lot of up and down there, but so you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, so it's the sort of thing. It's the sort of thing where if you have to export, people who'll be buying our goods will be buying them for cheaper, so they'll buy more of them compared to other markets where it might not be as cheap. So I guess I understand it from that perspective. But you know, for us as just plebs going on holidays, yeah, not an ideal time if you're going to America. You're going to pay a little bit more for that burger and that Budweiser. Mm. But there's not all doom and gloom. Like the Aussie dollar is trading pretty well at the moment against the Japanese yen, and they're opening their borders next month to tourism again, so that's great. And it's how well do you know the conversion rate between Aussie dollar and Indonesian rupiah? Do you keep it? Have you been to Bali much?
Oh, I haven't been to Bali for years, obviously.
At the moment, it's about 9,800.
9,800.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so 9,800, which I think is
that's
okay.
Right.
Like, I think it's okay.
That's about what I remember it to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, about around about, yeah, like close to that 10,000 rupees for a dollar. So, you know,
well,
swings
about,
and roundabouts.
We had a crew at the airport the other day for some other story, and there was a group of ladies wearing matching T-shirts saying the Real Housewives of Mandra heading to Bali. So I'm sure they'll be stoked at the exchange rate.
Oh, gosh. And now let's talk about the push to get to zero emissions, which is a big strategy that the Albanese government got elected upon. And a big part of it is going to be what happens in the mining industry, right? Because they're a big producer of emissions. And, you know, it's traditionally not seen as an industry that is the most green, the most environmentally friendly. But we're getting some mining companies now that are being a bit more proactive in pushing towards zero emissions.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of net zero targets. And so basically there is an organisation of sort of mining companies, the members of the International Council of Mining and Metals. So BHP Group and Glencore are part of that. And they are planning to ditch their diesel trucks. So obviously those giant trucks where, you know, the wheels are like triple the size of you, run by diesel. Obviously, you know what your car sucks up. They would be using a lot. So what this group is doing is they're looking at launching some pilot sites for zero emission options, sort of like hydrogen cars and that sort of thing, to help them move towards their net zero targets. And the interesting thing I find about this is that probably the discoveries they make will be able to carry over to sort of regular people if they make some interesting discoveries that could benefit not just mine sites, but hopefully wider society.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. And how long do you think it's going to be before we see like an absolute huge amount of EVs on metro roads?
Well, we are so far behind in Western Australia.
We really are, aren't we?
There are so many European countries that have outlawed the sale of petrol cars by 2030, which is 8 years. That
it's not very
soon.
It's going to come around real quick.
Yeah. And so we need to be on the front foot. I know, you know, they've launched the electric highway, but it's the price point. I think that still is so difficult for so many people. So I think it will be a couple of decades, or I could be surprised and it could just happen really quickly. You know, sometimes that happens. Who remembers what life was like before the iPhone? I don't.
Yeah, I know, right? And now, are you excited about the Waffle Grand Final tomorrow?
Absolutely. I think it'll be a great game. And obviously it's historic because it's returning to Leaderville Oval. So it's West Perth versus Claremont. Who are you going for?
Well, I don't really have any skin in the game when it comes to either of these teams, but I was talking to a waffle umpire yesterday at an event that I was at, and so I took the opportunity to really grill him on who he thought was the most likely. He wasn't umpiring in the grand final, but he said, look, Claremont is capable of definitely playing a winning game, but West Perth being the best team all year, no reason to think that they're not going to get the job done. That's how he put it.
Which is basically what everyone said about the AFL Grand Final, and look what happened. But around 14,000 people, that's a sellout crowd, are expected at Leaderville Oval, and the whole precinct is going to become Footyville from 6 a.m. So there's going to be roads closed, big screens, entertainment, so a whole footy festival, which is great to get people involved in the waffle. But if you can't be bothered to get involved in that, it is going to be live and free on Seven.
Yeah, and like this is going to be a big spectacle, right? Don't you reckon?
Oh my gosh, totally.
Like you've got all the streets closed off and people flocking there, and people who can't get a ticket will still be hopefully just hanging around soaking up the vibe.
Oh, absolutely. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Yeah,
why wouldn't you?
Get
love
into it.
Love it. And now talking with footy at the moment, let's talk about the Optus Stadium naming debate, because when the stadium was built, it was originally called Perth Stadium. Colin Barnett would have loved to have seen it kept as Perth Stadium as a branding thing for Western Australia, which I see some merit to that. Of course, the naming rights were sold to Optus, which was, you know, it could be worse. Like, do you remember when they were going to sell the naming rights to Subiaco Oval and it was going to be Crazy John's Oval for a little while there?
Oh my gosh, yes, I'd forgotten about that.
So compared to Crazy John's Oval, yeah. Optus Stadium sounds fine. Until, you know, the past week or so, when Optus has been involved in one of the worst data breaches in the history of Australia. And so now there is a debate about what we call our palace of football. Where's that at the moment?
So this was actually started by Jorn Sidma, one of the few Liberal politicians in Parliament. And he basically has come out and he's tweeted that, you know, he thinks it needs to change. So his exact tweet: "The Mark McGowan cheap and sordid decision to sell Perth Stadium's naming rights to Optus is looking even more terrible now. The contract should be annulled at Optus' expense and the original Perth name restored." So Basil Zemplis has also written in The West today saying he thinks that should happen. The government disagrees quite strongly. They sent a statement this morning to me and I will read it to you. I don't often read a statement word for word, but this one I think needs to be. "This is another pathetic and weak attack by a party that has no direction or idea. Every West Australian knows the WA Liberals destroyed the state's finances after 8.5 years in office. The Liberals' reckless and irresponsible budget management was the reason the naming rights deal was absolutely necessary as part of our efforts to repair the budget in 2017.
Yeah, well,
I mean, what you said,
it's kind of all true. Basically, back then, you know, Mark McGowan inherited a treasury that was basically, you know, a couple of 20-cent pieces, and that was it. And so he's had to build it up from scratch. And part of that was selling off the naming rights to Perth Stadium. But now, though, we're in a very different financial position.
Very different.
Just posted a massive $6 billion surplus. And so maybe now is the time to go, do you know what? While we can afford it, let's ditch Optus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there'd be legal ramifications for that. But
I'd say there would be. But that's the point that Basil made today.
Only a few million bucks.
Yeah, it would be 25 because it's halfway through. So the deal was made 10 years ago. It was a $50 million deal. And now, so it would be $25 million essentially. And that's the point that Basil made in the paper today. You know, that is a drop in the bucket compared to $6 billion. Yeah. You can see the tourism benefits of a Perth Stadium because it becomes so natural. Oh, Optus Stadium, Optus. You say it all the time without thinking, but it is quite amazing branding. So if it was Perth Stadium, that would be amazing as well. But it's one of those things where, you know, it is a signed contract and back 5 years ago, very different position.
Yeah, very different position. If it was me, I'd find a way to weasel out of the contract if you could. Call it Perth Stadium while we're swimming in cash. And then when, you know, the inevitable roller coaster starts going down the other side, as it always does in Perth, that's the time to sell it to see if Crazy John's is still
someone else.
boost juice. It's who else have we got? Clive Palmer? Yeah. Mineralogy.
Okay, we don't want your ideas anymore, Ben. Thanks so much.
Si, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Next week, you're going to be coming on the show with my good mate Tim Clark. He'll be filling in for me.
Yeah, I checked when you were on leave and I thought that's when I'll fill in for Matt.
Appreciate that. You have a great weekend.
Thanks.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Police today are on the hunt for a gunman after a suspected bikey link shooting in Nangarra yesterday. Channel 7 reporter Emily Baker is at the scene. Good morning, Em.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks. And so can you describe the situation out there in Nangarra?
Well, Ben, this is still very much an active investigation because, as you say, police are still hunting the person or people responsible for this shooting. There's a big police presence here in Nangarra, and a short time ago they opened the roadblock here on Sydney Road, so we can now see the workshop premises where it's believed the 34-year-old man was shot dead. It is a very big workshop. It's quite nondescript. It's surrounded by rural properties. There's a few cars parked out the front, but we are now seeing forensic investigators go in and collect what appears to be evidence, bagging it up. We've also got firefighters here. As I say, the investigation is still very much ongoing.
And what do we know about the man who has been shot?
Well, police are yet to reveal his identity. We know he is a 34-year-old man. Yesterday, we did see several people come here to the scene. They could have been friends or family of the man. There was quite an outpouring of grief. One of them was showing us his Rebels tattoo. So that's one of the biggest bikie clubs here in WA. And another person there is believed to be Rebels bikie Joseph Raimondi, who was former Rebels boss Nick Martin's best mate. So he was spotted at the scene last night.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be any qualms about showing off their bikie tats despite WA's supposedly tough new laws about showing bikie insignias. And now, what are the police saying as far as how the public should be looking at this situation? Should we be concerned that there is a assassin on the loose?
Well, it is quite concerning, isn't it? But senior homicide detectives tell us it appears to be a targeted attack, and that while the public should be vigilant, there is no real risk to the wider community, but they are still hunting the person or people responsible for this awful shooting. So we'll bring you the details as we get them throughout the day.
Yeah, no doubt. This is a story that everybody will be following very closely. Channel 7 reporter Emily Baker, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Thanks, Ben.
You're listening to The West Live.
Now, it seems both a long time ago and not such a long time ago that COVID was ravaging the community. But with so little of it seemingly around, you could be forgiven for forgetting the rules around isolation. And they could be about to change. Joining me now to help us understand what this all means is infectious diseases physician and microbiologist Professor Paul Griffin. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so it's been a while since we spoke last, and I've got to ask you, is COVID still a thing?
Oh, look, it's absolutely still a thing. I mean, I think it's great that the numbers have subsided and we're getting on with our lives without hearing quite as much about COVID, but we certainly need to be careful in forgetting altogether that it's still around, because while the numbers are low at the moment, we're starting to see them pick up in other parts of the world, and it's inevitable that our numbers will climb again in our country, and if we're not prepared for it, the consequences of that will be far greater than they need to be. So we do need to keep it in the back of our minds and make sure we get the basics right, and the most important thing, of course, is keeping up to date with vaccines and making sure people have symptoms that they get tested and stay home while they're infectious. So those sort of things are going to be part of what we do for the foreseeable future.
And talking about staying home, over the course of the pandemic, we've seen mandatory isolation go from 14 days to 7 days, talked about 5 days, and now there's a push to see it scrapped altogether, led by New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet. That's on the agenda at today's National Cabinet meeting. Is it time to scrap mandatory isolation?
Look, it's a really tricky one, and, you know, whichever way the rules go today, there's going to be people that are going to be happy with the decision and many that won't be. I personally think 5 days is a good balance at the moment. I mean, I think the implications of 7 or 14 days were just a little bit too great for where we are at this stage of the pandemic, and so I think a lot of people weren't getting tested because of those implications of having to stay home for a week or even 2 weeks as it was at the start. But, you know, I think 5 days is a good time for people to stay home. It's very likely most people will still even be infectious even at the end of 5 days, but if they wear a mask after that, we can reduce that risk even further. And you know, that 5 days at home will go a very long way to reducing how many people that those people who are positive and staying home would have infected otherwise. And if we scrap that altogether and we do see cases come back, then you know the consequences of people not staying at home will be very significant. So I think at the moment it's probably a good thing to keep, but I can see both sides of the argument. And you know, if we do get rid of it, we'll have to be really careful about the communication about how we manage that.
And what will be the point, do you think, when we can say, okay, now is the time we can kind of get rid of mandatory isolation? Will be a certain number of cases around the country? Will there be a point that we can actually spot?
Yeah, look, it's not based on any finite single number like that. I think it's taking into account the whole situation and also balancing the obvious consequences of, you know, the 5 days is, you know, in itself not without consequence. Well, it's obviously less so than 7 days. And, you know, I would personally like to see things like our booster uptake be far greater before we looked at reducing the 5 days even further, and perhaps look to see, you know, the other parts of the world where we're seeing transmission go up quite significantly, not have that be the case before we maybe looked at abolishing that altogether. But, you know, as I say, there's many things to be considered, including the unintended consequences of those rules. And, you know, all of those things will be discussed in great detail today.
And talking about other parts of the world, we're taking a bit of attention to Uganda at the moment because there's an outbreak of Ebola in that country. What do we know about that?
Look, we know this happens from time to time, and perhaps the frequency of some of these events is increasing due to all sorts of factors, including deforestation and climate change is probably having a factor. So infections that normally reside in animals that can cross over to people are seeming to happen at a greater number. I mean, Ebola is not a new virus, but unfortunately, it does carry a very high mortality, and the type of Ebola that's causing this has a mortality of between 40% and 100%. So it's a nasty virus, and the outbreak is pretty significant. I believe there's 36 or more cases at the moment, so it is something to watch. But very fortunately, it's something that is nowhere near as infectious as COVID. Of course, it does require close contact with infected fluid, and hopefully there'll be resources deployed to help those people there and control this outbreak fairly quickly.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. It's certainly a scary prospect for Uganda and the surrounding countries. Infectious diseases physician and microbiologist Professor Paul Griffin, thanks for joining us on The West Live.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
The southeast coast of the US is in a state of emergency after being battered by Hurricane Ian, which is one of the strongest ever to hit the US mainland, and there are now fears it could be the deadliest in Florida's history. Channel 7's US correspondent Tim Lester is in Fort Myers in Florida, literally the eye of the storm, and he joins us now. G'day, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
And so you're on the ground there. Can you describe to us what it's like?
Well, today, a remarkably different day to yesterday, of course, when we saw the storm go through. Today, we've been to Fort Myers Beach, in particular in Fort Myers, one of the areas worst hit by the storm, because very close to the actual point where the eye of the storm crossed continental America, came ashore and so did awful damage. And the village is flattened. It is just flattened. Whole stories just taken off buildings, a two-story building. We saw the owner walking around the top. It was crushed underneath, but had just been wiped clean off the top. An awful lot of boats in the town because it's a coastal fishing and leisure village, and the boats have just been big ones blown and swept by the rising sea into mangroves, dumped on roads, and bridges smashed, and tremendous destruction, increasing the closer you get to the coast. If you come back in three or 4 kilometres, you're more likely to see flooding, perhaps, from the swamping seawaters being sent back. But the destruction on the coast is terrifying.
Well, I'm looking at some images of it right now as you are talking about it, and it looks like houses have just been completely swept away, removed from their foundations, and it just, as you see, sort of the sea foam on the beach all be pushed to one side of the beach. That's what it looks like with these entire houses all pushed up against each other, against little ridges or whatever it might be. What's happened to all the people?
Well, most of them were warned to get out and did. Some rode it out. In fact, I know of one case where a man rode out the storm in a boat that was blown some distance, but has lived to tell about it. But one of the great unknowns here, Ben, is that how many people have died. We simply don't know. There is talk of a large number, but nothing formal. In fact, I think there's only one confirmed death, and that's in the eastern part of the state, where the bigger problem has just been the sheer rainfall coming from the hurricane. But we may yet learn of a significant death toll as rescuers are able to get to isolated islands and to areas that have been isolated by the rising waters and cut off by lack of bridges or bridges that have been blown out and the like. So we'll learn that in time, but at the moment there's just a sense that the full extent of this horror isn't really yet known.
Mm. And the people that are still there and that you're speaking to, what are they telling you? How are they? I can imagine they just must be in shock right now.
Completely. They're typically pretty positive. Typically, a lot of them will say that their greatest sense is just they're lucky to be alive. And there's, as you see in circumstances like this tragedy, a fair deal of philosophical take it on the chin kind of toughness in them, and a lot of talk today about how they'll rebuild. Florida is so hurricane prone. It's a fairly I guess if you want to live on the coast here, you take that risk, certainly. Certainly where these people have been, and but no, there's a fair deal of strength and pushing on. Whereas yesterday was quite different. Of course, yesterday there was just the plain fear as the hurricane went through.
Mm. And then the storm was briefly downgraded before regaining hurricane strength, and now it looks like it's barreling towards the South Carolina coast. What do we know about what is coming for those people?
Well, it shouldn't be as bad as it was on the west coast of Florida, simply because, although you're quite right, it appears to have recovered strength, and that was expected because hurricanes build out of hot water or warmer seawater, summertime seawater. That's why the Gulf of Mexico is such a sort of a hatching ground for hurricanes. But it has, we think, rebuilt some strength over the Atlantic, the other side of the Florida Peninsula, and meteorologists expect it to track north and cross the South Carolina coastline. But when it does, it won't have 241 kilometre an hour winds. They'll be gentler, and perhaps, although there is certainly some wind danger, perhaps the greater worry there might be just the sheer volume of rainfall it brings.
Mm. And it's hard to say at this early stage, but have there been any estimates of the repair bill, the damage bill that might have been caused by Hurricane Ian so far?
No, but we know historically these tend to run into the tens of billions at the very least, and this one will have a big, big damage bill. It's lashed a long portion of the coastline. In fact, by one estimate, there were seriously dangerous winds 500 to 600 kilometres from the storm, from the actual storm centre. So, you know, not 241 kilometre an hour winds, but winds that were of a potential danger to those around them. So it's a giant storm, and damage across the sort of area we're talking about in Florida will be very costly.
Mm, yeah, you can only imagine. And just the cleanup effort, and we know from past experience that America hasn't always had the best track record when it comes to how they deal with these storms. We sure send our thoughts and prayers to everybody there in Florida and the people of South Carolina in the days to come. Channel 7 US correspondent Tim Lester, you stay safe too, mate, and thanks for your time on the West Live.
Good on you, Ben. Nice chatting.
You're listening to The West Live.
It's a high-stress environment, but when does the cut and thrust of politics cross the line? It's a question in the spotlight after WA Senator Dorinda Cox was yesterday accused of bullying her staff. The West's state political reporter, Josh Zimmerman, joins us now with the details of the allegations. G'day, Josh.
G'day, Ben. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. And so can you break this story down for us? What are the allegations and how did they come to light?
Yeah, so Dorinda Cox is a WA senator. She first joined Parliament September last year. She filled a casual vacancy and then was re-elected in May. So she's only been in Parliament for a year at this point. In that time, the allegation is that six of her staff, or the entirety of her original staff from when she first joined Parliament, have left, and they've left because they've allegedly been bullied by Senator Cox. And this has come to light through an official complaint that's been lodged with both the Greens and the Parliamentary Workplace Support Service, which is an independent, I guess, investigator based out of Parliament House. The complaint is from one of those six staff members that have left, and they have laid out a range of quite detailed allegations against Senator Cox.
Mm. And so what do we know about the process from this point as far as that complaint that's been lodged with the Greens leader and the Parliamentary Workplace Support Service?
So the Greens defer to the independent investigator, PWSS. They'll wait for that process to play out. The results are then tabled to the Greens party room, and they decide, I guess, the fate of Ms. Cox or Senator Cox at that point in time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so what are the range of outcomes in a case like this?
Yeah, so I think that PWSS is quite limited in the disciplinary action that they can actually levy against the senator. They can make some recommendations, but ultimately a senator is an elected member of parliament, and it's up to parliament to decide how they deal with her. The Greens, I guess, in very serious cases, could expel somebody from their party. That person would then still remain in parliament as an independent. But that is only in a very extreme case, certainly not suggesting that is what will happen in this instance. And these are only allegations at this point in time. We don't know, you know, for sure whether they'll be stood up or not.
Yeah, there's a process that has to unfold here. And we will wait for that to happen before making any real sweeping generalisations. And now there's another Green senator also in the spotlight after a former advisor had to apologise for her appalling conduct. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this one dates back a year. The other Green senator is Lydia Thorpe. She's from Victoria. It was reported at the time that two Indigenous elders went to Parliament House for a meeting with Lydia Thorpe. One of them claims that they were verbally abused in that meeting, that Senator Thorpe got very aggressive, belittled them, talked down to them, left one of these elders in tears. That was reported at the time. A year later, so today, Senator Thorpe's staff member has resigned. He was in that meeting. He sent an email to both of these elders as one of his last acts before leaving Parliament, apologising for what he described as Lydia Thorpe's shocking and appalling behaviour during the meeting. He said it was the most embarrassing thing he'd ever seen during his time, not just in Parliament, but his entire working career. And Lydia Thorpe so far has refused to apologise over that issue. She describes the meeting as a robust discussion and the kind of thing that just happens in Parliament from time to time, which I guess is kind of the problem, because that sort of behaviour maybe has become more accepted in Parliament House than it would be anywhere else in Australia.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's a bit like a newsroom sometimes, I think, some of the behaviour that, that we see. Yeah, maybe you wouldn't see them in a normal workplace, but it went across the line. That's the issue here. Lydia Thorpe, certainly feisty. She's been on the West Live before, and it always has extremely strong opinions. I guess we'll wait to see how it all plays out. The West State political reporter, Josh Zimmerman, thanks for joining us on the West Live.
No worries. Thanks, Ben. Take it easy, man.
Fearless Friday with Jeff Parry.
Yes, and the man himself joins me in the studio. We would never downgrade your dog to a little poodle. Yapping chihuahua.
Corgi.
Yup, yup, yup. Yep. No. A big Rottweiler.
Do corgis bark? They do.
I don't know if the Queen's corgis did. I think they were quiet.
Yeah. Well, welcome back too, mate, because it was Clarkie last
Thank
week.
Thank you.
And,
yes.
And you're back.
You soldiered on.
Yes, we did.
He'll be filling in for me next week as well. I'm taking a week off for school holidays. Now, let's talk budget surplus, because we knew that the budget numbers for WA were going to look pretty healthy, even healthier than expected.
An embarrassment of riches, isn't it, for the Premier? An embarrassment because he's having trouble spending it. He's got so much money. It highlights how by the length of the street Western Australia has performed compared to other states and the federal government, who probably won't see budget surpluses for a long time. You know, of course, we know that it's a result of a very sustained iron ore price. We're much to the chagrin of a lot of the other premiers, we're getting a fairer deal from our GST now, and so, you know, so we're doing okay that way. The government has shown a lot of spending restraint, a lot of expenditure restraint, and has ended up in this enviable position of having $6 billion as a sort of a bit of a war chest. But you don't think that. That people haven't got their hands up, groups haven't got their hands up to say, well, give some of it to us.
Well, a lot of public sector workers want a pay rise at the moment.
They want 5%, and at the moment they're getting about 3%. And well, plus a $3,000 bonus, but it's not quite there. But McGowan's just saying, no, that's it for the moment, but that's the top offer, that's the best offer you're going to get.
Well, the problem is if you give everybody, even though you can't afford a big pay rise, it's pretty hard to wind that back if then you know, the economy takes a bit of a downturn, and it doesn't take long before, you know, the pay bill starts to weigh down the economy. And we know health is obviously a huge proportion of the annual budget too. There are problems there, but they're not as easily fixed as just throwing money at them.
No, it's not. And it's a lot of the, you know, a lot of the infrastructure projects that the government had on the books have been put back because construction is just maxed out. They just can't get the workers. They can't get the companies. You know, they've spent, I think, what is it about the infrastructure spend now is $7 or $8 billion. And they just can't sustain that. So, you know, but I mean, you know, I think there's something, the welfare groups are certainly calling for some, you know, help. With, as I said yesterday, our struggle street's got a lot longer now for a lot of people who, you know, who are going backwards. The wages haven't kept up enough. There's a growing list of working poor. WACOS was saying yesterday, food bank demand for food bank or on food bank is up something like 21%. You know, people have never ever been, you know, been in that position before, or have been on the edge, and now they're basically going under. And they're saying, look, these people need help. The people who administer them and run these services need help because they're not included in this. You know, in this increased pay offer, and that they want a rental relief scheme as well. So, you know, I think there's something to be said that something needs to be done in that sector, because I mean, I don't think anyone's disputing that the people who are really doing it tough are a growing block of our community.
Yeah, I think absolutely. Like, there are things to spend money on. That is one of them. I think tourism is another thing that they could really look at, supercharging that, because you've got this rare opportunity of having all this money. It's how they spend it when it comes to tourism, right? Like the tourism commercial, I don't know how that's going to go. When I was over in Queensland last week, I was watching the TV, free to air, and in the space of about an hour, I saw the WA Walking on a Dream commercial with the flying whale shark. I saw an ad for tourism in Victoria, and I saw one for Tasmania as well. I can tell you ours was the worst.
Did anyone come up and say, hey, that flying
whale sharks have you seen over your way?
Yeah, is that guaranteed if I
but
come
seriously
over?
Though, like I was looking at them going, the Tassie ad looks great, the Victorian ad looks great, the WA ad looks great, but what the heck is it? Like, it's what is the message there that people thinking about a holiday can action? And I just don't see, you know, I just don't see that being successful.
That campaign got a touch up at the time, and the questions were legitimately asked. What are your KPIs? I mean, that this would be a success. I mean, how many tourists coming in would constitute this campaign being a success? And they don't want to go there because, I mean, that's a rod for your own back if you start naming, you know, start putting numbers on it. But the jury is still out on that ad, no doubt about it. Like, and I've seen the Melbourne one.
It's not that it isn't pretty. It's a pretty ad, but
yeah, it's excellently, you know, it's very very computer generated, very highly produced. You know, distorts, you got bending bow
trees.
What does
it tell you about what you can do if you come to Western Australia? You know what I mean?
No, I agree. Go to Elizabeth Quay.
But even that, what can you do there? Like, those people having a little dance out on the end of the bridge, like, what the heck? You know, like, and that's why I think, like, you look on social media, that's been so successful as a driver for tourism, because you're literally seeing things that you can imagine yourself doing. And I think it needs to be more literal if you're getting people to spend their money. Like, to just look at it as a concept and go, oh, that's pretty, sure, fair enough. But if you're trying to get them to spend money, which is the aim of the game, I don't know. And now, earlier this week, we were talking on the West Live about the new legislation that the state government wants to bring in to address antisocial behaviour in our nightlife precincts, the so-called PEP laws. What did you make of that?
I think the spirit of it and the intent of it is very good. I think some of it will probably work, but there are difficulties there that the government did have problems and the police had problems addressing when they rolled this out. I mean, as I said, the intent. Enza Racco, who's the widow of Giuseppe Racco, who was one punched and died back in 2020, has been working on this for, you know, a couple of years, just to basically along the point that people who commit crimes should never be allowed back into that area, or certainly, you know, should be excluded from that area for a length of time. And that's what the government has done. But she did say at the presentation, this has gone further than she thought it would. So this sort of two there's two areas. There's the mandatory ones, which, you know, the exclusion 5 years goes on people who've been committed, still in jail for murder, assault, sexual assault, drinks, biking. That's an interesting one. They automatically get a 5-year ban. The other ones are they're sort of like a temporary thing, which I described as a move on notice on steroids. So instead of a move on notice, you get banned for up to 6 months on the say-so of a police inspector. Now, I think the mandatory ones, the what's not been sort of guaranteed or assured is how the police are actually going to, you know, some guy's been away for 15 years. Most of the coppers, you know, wouldn't know who he just wanders in and does his thing. And, you know, how there'd be hundreds of them, you know, how the police are expected to pick these people out from a crowd and say, hang on, you know, you shouldn't be here, here's 2 years in jail. The other one, though, is the temporary one, and I think the problems with that are the not infringement on civil liberties, but there's the more a propensity to get things wrong in that case. So a guy's gobbing off at police, the policeman's got a body camera, it's being watched by live. Being watched by an inspector, so it might be a bit ropey, but it's streamed into wherever the inspector is, and he's looking at it, and maybe the inspector's having a rough night, and he says, bugger here,
slap a ban on him.
Just get rid of him for 6 months. Now, I think there's no appeal. Now, I think that's probably one of the flaws. The fact that you have no appeal against some bloke who's probably having a bad night or could be having a bad night or whatever, or he doesn't get the context of what's going on, this is, look, sort this out, just get rid of him.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a problem there that need to be addressed. So there's a lot of trust being put into the police on the beat, which we normally do anyway, but I think that goes that little step further.
Yeah, like I think a move on notice serves that purpose anyway. Yep. Like you're removing the person from the area. To me,
so you're an obnoxious drunk.
Yeah,
you're bugger gone. Off you're for gone. 24 hours and
6 months. Like to be able to just that to me is a punishment that needs to have maybe a little bit more oversight over how it's implemented than what is proposed under this current legislation. It'll be interesting to see how it moves through the Parliament. Not that anybody can really do anything about it.
No, they can't. There's a lot of things that can't be done because the government has the majority and can just push these things through quickly, as it is doing on with some of this new legislation. It is, as I understand it, the laws will be reviewed at some stage by the Ombudsman. I mean, and the behaviour of the police will always be monitored, I guess, by the CCC and Police Internal Affairs. But I think these are just sort of, these are, particularly with the temporary exclusions, which not that temporary, 6 months, there's the real risk that things can go wrong here and you've got no comeback on the police, and meanwhile you're banned for 6 months. Getting drunk and misbehaving shouldn't be a 6 month ban. Charge them.
Yeah, charge them. Exactly. If they're doing something that bad,
put them before the courts.
Yeah, I agree.
Not just some discriminatory or indiscriminate use of a temporary exclusion order.
Yeah. And you'll be digging into this issue a bit deeper on Flashpoint this week.
We're looking at it for Sunday. I'm filling in for Tim again this Sunday, and we'll be looking at that and talking to Enza, the widow of Pep Rocco, and also Danny Hodgson's on with us as well. He's another victim of a one punch. He's his attacker got, I think, 3 years or less, just under 3 years and 8 months, I think, for his attack, and he's of course living with probably lifetime debilitating injuries.
Yeah, it's just very, very sad. And so watch that, Channel 7 on Sunday.
10 o'clock, yep.
And now let's talk National Cabinet. Anthony Albanese is meeting with the state premiers and chief ministers this morning as we speak. And one of the main things on the agenda, as we've mentioned already today, is this issue of scrapping mandatory COVID isolation. And now Dominic Perrottet wants it. Other premiers have said that they want to see what the chief medical officer has to say on the matter. Which way do you think it's going to go?
Dominic Perrottet from New South Wales apparently is the driving force on it. As I understand it, the WA government, certainly we were told yesterday, hadn't had any chief medical officer, chief health officer advice on it. So I'm not sure which way Mark McGowan will fall on this. Look, It's just treated like a flu now. In fact, people are getting flu that's worse than anything COVID's dished up for a lot of...
It's a bad flu going around.
I had it. And people I've spoken to have had it, and it's, you know, it knocks you around. So I guess, you know, I think it's probably time to get rid of it, just gut feeling, just to punt it. No one really sort of seems to give two hoots too much about COVID anymore, unless you're in a hospital or in aged care, where it's still causing problems. But I think it's probably time to go.
Yeah. Well, like I was in an event last week where it was packed. Like it was absolutely packed. A few hundred people in a small space. Everybody was, you know, like because of the music, yelling at each other from about, you know, 5 inches away from each other's faces.
And I thought, each other with saliva.
And I thought, if I don't catch COVID for a second time here, then COVID is gone. And I didn't catch it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's. I don't even know what the numbers are now. I mean, they only come out once a week now, don't they?
Once a week.
They just sort of like it's an email that you don't bother to open.
Well, the AMA doesn't want the mandatory isolation scrap just yet. They came out this morning. The president of the Australian Medical Association, Steve Robson, told ABC News Breakfast.
Not that surprised.
They didn't want it. Put the public at risk, he reckons.
Yeah, not surprised. I mean, there are an abundance of caution at the AMA, and I've always sort of pushed back a little bit against moving too quickly, but I think. I think they're pushing against the tide on this one. I think most people are sort of in the position now where, well, yeah, it's COVID.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, fine. I think you're right. And now, are you going to hang around for the Wild West?
Yes, please.
The Wild West. Joining me now on the microphone is Westlife producer Shannon Bevan. G'day, Shannon.
Hello.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good, really good.
That's good.
And now, earlier today, Jeff, on the Westlife, we were talking, of course, about the shooting that happened in Nangarra overnight with links to bikies, where the police suspect at the moment. And now we can reveal the victim's name.
Yeah, so the man that was shot dead in the workshop in Nangarra is believed to be 34-year-old Joe Versace. So tributes have starting to pour through for him online. You know, a lot of his friends and family are shocked and dismayed by his death. But we're also hearing, you know, like reports from some of our reporters on the scene. They've been speaking to locals and they're saying that they heard and saw motorbikes speeding through the area at the time of the attack. So, I mean, you know, we don't know for certain, but it's looking more and more likely that it is bikey related.
What do we know from those online posts about Mr. Versace? Are they mentioning any links to bikies?
Or? No, not any links to bikies. We know that he's a father, and he's a father of a daughter, and that's pretty much all we kind of know at this point. I mean, we've got photos of him. He has got a lot of tattoos.
What do you think, Jeff, when you hear about more bikie violence?
Seems to be pretty regular occurrence, doesn't it? The cops have their hands full. And I think it does. I think what it says, the impression that it has on the community is, well, hang on, you know, this is obviously a community-wide problem. We need the police to be proactive about this. Go and crunch them. So they've got, you know, they have no qualms about, raiding bikie clubhouses, and I'm sure that's probably going to happen in the next, you know, they've got to go and kick a few doors in, as the cops say, and that'll happen. But it just seems to be, they're getting all these laws, the police, to sort of deal with bikies, but, you know, you're still getting these drive-by shootings. So, but, you know, how do you teach an outlaw not to be an outlaw?
Yeah.
Outlaws will do what outlaws do.
100%. And this is what we've spoken about before with our good mate Ben Harvey, who's a bit of an expert on outlaw motorcycle gangs.
He certainly is.
Some might say he's a bit of an obsession with them. And as he's pointed out when we've spoken about things like, you know, sort of if you show a gang insignia, if you have tattoos, you know, you cop a penalty for that. You know, these are people that commit serious crimes. They're not going to worry about a fine or a short stint in jail for showing an insignia. Like, this just doesn't bother them at all. And if they're willing to kill somebody, then, you know, anything that the government can do as far as talking tough around the issue is probably not going to scare them.
I think what was interesting too about that it was certainly reported in the West this morning, mm-hmm. was that one of Nick Martin's best mates showed up. Because Seven News broke that story during the news last night, and it only happened a couple of hours beforehand, and he was there pretty quickly, apparently.
Yeah, so you read that, and it's kind of hard to it's hard to imagine that people who are, you know, known members of the Rebels and reasonably high up, I guess, from all we understand, it's kind of hard to imagine that they would just pop out, you know, to some unknown person's worksite and then hug their family members and whatnot.
Correct, so, hugging the sort of the people who've come to sort of pay their respects, and it's, you know, very emotional scenes and all that sort of thing.
So while we don't know officially, I you know, you would hazard a guess that it's a reasonably well-informed.
That's where the smart money is.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some breaking news for both of you this morning.
Ooh.
Mandatory COVID isolation has been scrapped.
Oh.
It has been officially scrapped. Ministers agreed to end mandatory isolation requirements for COVID-19 effective as of October 14, with each jurisdiction implementing the change via relevant public health legislation. So apparently they agreed to end the pandemic leave disaster payment effective on the same date, and to protect people in high-risk settings and those who are especially vulnerable to COVID, National Cabinet agreed to continued targeted financial support for casual workers on the same basis as the disaster payment scheme for workers in aged care, disability care, Aboriginal health care and hospital care sectors as well. So,
well, that's good news. I'm glad that they're going to continue, you know, the payments for people who work in high-risk settings because it would be quite the tragedy if you had to go to work because you, you know,
you're worried about your income,
couldn't afford to eat and, you know, all of that sort of thing, and especially if you're in a high-risk area. So
I wonder whether Dominic Perrottet did a little ring around of the other premiers and state ministers, territory ministers, to see whether he's going to get that one through, so he's not going to be embarrassed to have it knocked back, and whether there was any dissent, you know, maybe one premier, you know, who knows
wonder what our premier thought of it.
Well, I think I think now all the premiers are secretly, and in case of Dominic Perrottet, not so secretly, in favour of scrapping mandatory ISO because of the chronic worker shortages. Mm. But I don't think anybody necessarily, apart from Perrottet, wanted to be on the record as saying scrap it. Everybody else has seemed to be taking the cautious approach. Well, let's leave it up to the, you know, the chief health officer. Let's rely on the medical advice so it's not on us if everything goes badly. But I think they'll be quite satisfied with this result.
Interestingly enough, so the As we know, the COVID numbers are now coming out once a week, so they're not out yet today. But last week, on the 23rd of September, so that was what, last
Thursday,
public holiday and all that sort of thing, 2,784 active cases in WA. So that's really quite low.
For the whole week.
Yep.
Yeah, right. So that is low.
It's very low. Like, there'd be more people who have gastro in one suburb. And so let's talk about the Queen. And so just in case we haven't had enough talking about Her Late Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II. So now we know why she died.
Yeah, we do. In something that's probably not going to be much of a surprise, her official cause of death was old age.
There you go.
So her death certificate has been released, which is quite interesting. So, you know, it's got her full name, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary, surname Windsor, occupation, Her Majesty the Queen.
That's what it says under occupation.
It says under occupation.
That's amazing.
So that's great. And it says, you know, when she started. So her time of death at Balmoral was recorded at 3:10. Mm-hmm. So this has also now thrown a whole bunch of speculation, you know, as to when the family was told, right? Because as we know, Harry didn't find out until about 6 p.m. that night. So it's quite a long wait. And then obviously Prince Edward, his wife Sophie, and William were on the plane on the way to see the Queen. So from what we now understand, they were told mid-air.
Wow. Right.
So they didn't land in time. So it was only Charles and her daughter Anne that were there at the time of her death.
But they were told mid-air, but were they? What do we know? What time they were told?
We don't know what time.
The in-favour royals, as opposed to the out-of-favour royal.
No, we don't. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think they landed about 4 p.m. because Harry was about 2 hours after them, right? Yeah. So I think they were told pretty soon after.
Maybe they lost Harry's phone number, or temporarily lost his phone number.
Well, maybe, but there was a lot of confusion about how he was getting there. He was trying to get his jet.
Yeah, there was lots of stuff going on. So yeah, it's just how it goes.
So we're going to dismiss that conspiracy theory that he was kept on the outer for a couple of hours.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Are we going to, or just in general?
Yeah. And now, you might remember this, Jeff. We spoke about pizzas once before, and you gave me a recommendation of Pizza on Cambridge as your top pizza spot. Yes. Well, do you know what? That's now my pizza spot.
Is that right?
That is my pizza spot. I love it. I love it there. Like, the Chicken Club is just a bloody ripper.
They do some great pizzas there. So I haven't been there for a long time because, as you know, I don't live in that area anymore. So
still very good.
But you know, maybe I'll buy one on the way home.
I bring it up.
Have to get a pizza from Eugene's in East Fremantle.
Oh, okay.
They're so good.
Right, okay. Yeah. All right.
Put that on your list for this weekend.
Eugene. And also put on your list one place not to buy pizzas from, and that is Coles, because they've had a pizza recall.
Ah. Pull the pineapple Hawaiian ones up, because people won't buy them.
Four flavours of the Chernobyl Saba Australian pizza. So they're like the frozen
Chernobyl
ones. Chernobyl.
Oh.
That was the first
red Chernobyl
flag. That was the first red flag.
No, different spelling.
It glows before it even goes into the oven.
Genobile. So no premium salami, no premium margarita. The premium garlic and the premium pomodoro pizzas have all been recalled, taken off the shelves. So those ones have use-by dates of the 11th of October. Mm. So they're basically just saying that they're not safe to eat.
Without any further information.
So, is it because of the use-by date, or there's something else going on?
Well, I think it is. I mean, the use-by date, I think it's something else, because I think that the use-by date is...
How's the use-by date?
Oh, wait, sorry. Yeah, so the use-by date was 2023, but it's actually already past the use-by date. So they're just saying that, no good.
Oh, here's the thing, right? So the correct use-by date was 11th of the 10th, 2022, but the pizzas were printed with the use-by date that said 11th of the 10th, 2023. So people might be thinking, I've got this pizza for another year. Yeah. I don't have to get onto it straight away.
I don't know, though. Buying anything that has a use-by date of a year in advance
you've got to question it.
I suppose that's what happens with tin stuff, though.
It's all the preservatives they put in it. I mean, you know, a good mix of preservatives will keep something forever.
It always really disturbs me when you find, like, an Easter egg at the end of the year, and then you're when you open it, like, they're still completely good, and you think, I really shouldn't be eating this. It's really bad.
But you do anyway, because you're just desperate for a sweet treat. We've all been there.
Yeah.
And now let's talk Boost Juice. Mm. And so the popular chain of fruit juice stores has been really descended into controversy after a TikToker has slammed them for their hiring practices, or specifically what they say in interviews.
Yeah, so this Perth teenager has put them on blast on TikTok. She said that she went in for her first interview, and she wore black leggings and a black shirt, you know, to kind of show, like, what she would wear during...
It's kind of the Boost Juice uniform.
During the day. Yeah. And then so she was offered a second job interview, and she decided for the second one that she would, you know, dress up a little bit and go and, I guess, like, you know, a bit more formal. And she said that instead of, like, you know, sitting her down and asking her more questions, the woman took her to the kiosk, said, you know, like, well, you're clearly not dressed for work, which she found, you know, quite embarrassing. And then she said that she only asked her two questions and mostly wanted to know what she was doing on the weekend.
Mm.
Oh. So I don't think she got the job. But, yeah, it just sounds very, very strange. So, you know, she's on TikTok basically saying, you know, worst job interview I've ever had. And obviously people are very much,
On her side. Onto it. And people have jumped on as well, saying, you know, that matches with my experiences doing interviews or working at Boost Juice. And so the company has now come out and apologised to this girl and said, oh, you know, you shouldn't have been treated like that. But it's an interesting one, right? Like, the thing that amazes me most about it is, given how short the hospitality industry is for workers at the moment, they have time to do a second interview for someone to make some juice. It's like, if you were a human with a pulse and, you know, you're not likely to set the kiosk on fire, you're hired. Yeah. I thought that would be pretty much the extent of the job interviews at the moment.
What's your worst job interview experience, Jeff?
I don't know. I've been largely successful. I haven't had to have a job interview for a long, long time. I can't remember the last time.
Fair enough. What about yours, Ben?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. It's also been a while since I've had to do a job interview, not quite as long as Jeffrey's. let me see. I once had a really bad job interview for Kmart that was kind of like a trial kind of interview. It was interview and trial. And so they involved I had to have like a trolley full of items to stack on the shelf from different parts of the store. And I had like a finite amount of time to do it.
Like a competition.
It was like a competition. It was like 3 minutes.
That was fun.
And so off I went. I was just like banging them up on the shelf. I was like maybe 18 or something. And I thought I did a great job. I got every box done in the 3 minutes. And the dude has gone and walked around and said, it's not very neat though, is it? And I was yeah. Well, I wasn't sure what the criteria was. And he's like, no. And he said to me, he said, I'll never forget. He goes, I just don't know if you're really Kmart material.
Oh, slap.
Ben.
I was like, yeah. So look at me now, buddy. Look at me now. Look at me now, Bruce from Kmart Burragoon.
Joke's on him.
Yeah, exactly. Look how far we've come. And now, here's an interesting one. So I'm assuming this is a local government story.
It is.
And so, like when you take out your rubbish to the bin, you open the lid of the wheelie bin, you're usually met by some sort of an aroma. Usually it's not very nice. But now, what are there going to be fines for people whose bins are too stinky?
Yeah, so the town of Victoria Park is introducing a new waste law, and locals could be stung up to $5,000 if they let their green topped garden organics bin go, you know, disgusting. The mayor has confirmed the new laws, but she said that reports that the council would deploy bin smellers.
There's a job.
To scour its suburbs were exaggerated.
How often though? Because they get picked up, what, every 2 weeks?
No. So if you're on the 3-bin system, the green bin, which is like your compost.
And you put your food waste in there?
Food waste and all
and
of that.
And your garden clippings and whatnot?
Yeah, all of that one. That's weekly. And then your red bin, which is like your rubbish and your recycling bin generally. Well, this is what it is for me in Frio. Then they're like every fortnight. You should know this. We're in the same council. You don't put your bins out, obviously.
I don't put my bins out.
Well, it's an interesting one, right? Because in the suburbs where people have just the 2 bins set up, in the your red top bin where you, like your household food waste stuff goes, it'd be in a plastic bag with probably a knot tied in it, which kind of seals in the aromas.
Yep. Yeah.
But with those winners going into the green top bin,
chuck it all
it's
in.
Like you'd have your leftover meat scraps and stuff. Yep. It would get stanky.
Well, I mean, what if your dog died? Where are you going to put it? You just got to put it in the bin.
I don't think that you're technically.
That's the only.
Throwing their dog in the bin when it dies?
Well, I mean, that's the only thing I can imagine where you're going to stink your bin up.
This is taking a dark turn.
So I think what happens.
Like leftover bits of chicken off cuts and stuff like that would smell exactly the same as a dead dog.
Look, I don't know. If you said crab shells, prawn heads, I would get that.
Yeah, but you put the prawn heads in the freezer until the day before, until the day of bin day.
Yeah.
But I think basically, so. What it sounds to me like this is, right, have you ever, you know, sometimes you forget to put your bins out.
Yeah.
And if you forget to put your bins out,
it's going to cost you
$5,000. It starts to stink, you know, and the compost can go. Look, our bins were, I had my bins cleaned this year.
Oh, professionally.
Best $35 I have ever spent because it was disgusting. I live in like a townhouse. I didn't want to empty the bin in my yard. And then I didn't want to have to wheel it out into the street in the middle of the night and try to wash it out, you know, down a drain without anybody seeing me. And I just thought, I'm just going to outsource this. And it was
He came and poured it down the drain.
No. He had a van.
Oh, he took it with him.
Took it with him. I left my bins out.
He went round the corner.
I don't know what he did, but he did that. And I'm happy happy with it.
The council bin sniffers won't get you.
They won't get me. And you know what? Best $35 I've spent this year.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah. What are you guys up to this weekend?
Might get into a bit of bin sniffing. I don't know. I'm hosting Flashpoint on Sunday again.
Of course.
Tim's got a week's leave this time after London. So I'm doing that. So that'll be interesting and probably maybe spend a bit of time with the grandkids.
Grab a pizza. Yeah,
it's school holidays.
Yeah, it is indeed. One more week.
There's a little bit of
make the most of
grandkid time there.
Yeah. Very nice.
And what about you, Shannon?
As always, I'm off for a couple of lunches. That's how I spend my weekends. And maybe some gardening while the weather's nice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Put those clippings in the bin.
Exactly.
Clean some bin. Gardening, clean bit of DIY bin. Around the house.
You'd be surprised the difference it makes.
Guys, thank you for joining me on the show. You won't talk to me next week. You talk to Tim Clark. I'll talk to you again soon. Cheers.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, that's it from me for the week. Thanks for your company, folks. Massive thanks to my producers, Shannon Bevan, Mel Bonolo, and Kate Ryan. We'll be back on Monday live from 8:45 a.m. And don't forget to subscribe to The West Live on your favourite podcast player and give us a rating and a review because it really helps us out.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on the west.com.au to deliver.